This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
This on? Hello?
We're all science people.
Science!
Exactly.
We know it's a good idea because it's lasted.
We can teach kids and they get it.
There's chemistry in here. There's biology in here.
It's in whiskey. It's in ice cream. It's in who you fall in love with. That's the recipe for success.
We can make the world better for everybody.
Starting now.
Welcome to Science Rules. I'm your host, Bill Nye. This is the show where science rules. And it's a call-in show, people. If you want to be on the show, and I hope you do, please go to askbillnye.com and type on in. I want to hear what's on your mind. I want you to call us. Tell me what's keeping you up at night. What drives you? What science question might be on your mind? And as always, I am joined, of course, by science writer, editor, dear friend, Corey S. Powell. Greetings, Corey.
Greetings, Bill. It's good to be here. Not just with you, but with this whole team of talented engineers and producers who digitally modify this podcast into an extra appealing form, modifying us and perfecting us into something better.
Modifying us?
Yes.
Making us better suited to the conditions here in the recording studio. It's an interesting coincidence because today we are joined by Dr. Rob Fraley. He's a World Food Prize laureate and the former CTO, that's Chief Technology Officer of Monsanto.
Dun, dun, dun.
And he helped develop the very first genetically modified seeds of any kind. Rob, Dr. Fraley, welcome.
Good to be here and good to be with you guys.
You're retired now, right?
I am.
So that
but
makes
I'm
you
still
a
working
consultant.
Harder than ever.
Yeah, that's what happens to guys like you. Now, Rob, you grew up on a farm, and this is how you ended up doing what you do. Is that right?
Absolutely. I grew up on a small farm in Illinois, and we had crops and a little bit of livestock. And growing up on a farm does a couple things. First of all, you get to see the cycle of life really up close and personal, with livestock and with crops. And you know, one of the things you learn is you learn early on where food comes from. And I can remember my grandma going to the hen house and pulling out that chicken and showing me how she turned it into a drumstick when I was about 5 years old. And I also remember, things like, my dad sitting around the kitchen table watching that rainstorm that we needed kind of go too far to the north and the frustration and, the challenges that farmers face as they try to grow a crop.
Even the precariousness in some ways.
Being close to the land like that, you really get a sense of how farmers, they live on the farm. Most of them have the goal of passing that farm on to their kids. So, there's a real sense of environmental stewardship. So, I kind of took those things with me as I went through college. And after I finished my degree at Illinois, I got the luck of a draw to get out to San Francisco right in the time when the biotech world was starting.
So when did Monsanto, was it Monsanto that hired you?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I joined Monsanto in 81. I retired last year, so I had 40 great years of, not only watching the science and, having those spectacular moments when we could first tell that the technology was working. I learned the patience of 15 years of, developing and testing and making products work and pretty cool. We had a group of about a half a dozen scientists. In a nutshell, what we were able to do was harness a natural process involving a specific kind of bacterium called Agrobacterium, which can naturally insert genes into plants. And the classic example is if you see a tree or a rose bush that has that that bulge on it.
The goiter.
The gall.
The gall.
That's a bacterium putting a gene in a plant cell to make those cells grow. We took out the genes that caused the gall and replaced with the gene that, you know, we could track and had ultimately value.
Now, what was the original hope? I mean, what was the Monsanto's vision? They're like, we're going to hire you and we want to make what?
Blank.
What did they think they were going to do by genetically engineering these plants?
I think it was a couple of things. You know, back in the 70s and early 80s, you know, they were looking for new businesses to get into. They'd been in the chemistry business largely. They, you know, like a lot of companies, they started back at the turn of the century in the last century. Yeah, you and I know what that means, right?
Yeah, well, things are going to change. That's
so they were looking for
on.
Something new, and then you know, one of the scientists there, Ernie Jaworski, he's passed away now, but he was a real leader. He was actually involved in getting the company to make early investments in some of the biotech industry, and he was looking at this as a new opportunity, and things meshed. I mean, you know, having the place to be able to bring this science together, having a company that had, you know, agricultural origins and had a sense of what it would take to create new products and that, you know, that farmers would focus on. So, you know, our first products were really targeted at helping farmers. We introduced genes into cotton that would help protect the plant against insects damage.
Boll weevils, right?
Cotton bollworms.
Bollworms, correct.
Bollworms, yeah. The other big cotton pest. I mean, you're right on track there. Eventually, we introduced that same approach in corn because corn gets eaten up by caterpillars and worms as well. And then the weed control.
It's important for everybody to remember that farming is not natural. This is quite an insight.
And we've been working on it for the last 8,000 years.
Yeah.
And fortunately, we're getting better every year.
Yeah, because if you stop farming, it goes back to a prairie or a forest or a desert or whatever it was.
And you stop eating, which has got important consequences.
Well, for humans, yeah.
Right. Now, back in the day, there was this very successful branding slogan, you know, better living through chemistry. But somehow, you know, the equivalent slogan, you know, better eating through genetic modification, that never took hold. Why not?
I don't know. And the irony, of course, is that everything we eat is in some way or another been genetically modified.
And wait a minute. I see labels that say proudly non-GMO.
Well, there's always an argument on what is a GMO. And actually, as we progress in our science, that answer gets more and more complicated.
Or blurrier.
But yeah. Genes are constantly being evolved and changed by nature, and they're actually being moved in between species. And so maybe it was a little scary early on when you talked about, you know, being a, you know, genetically modified organism.
Frankenfood, yes.
You know, and the way I like to describe it is if you have an iPhone and you add an app to that iPhone, you haven't changed the iPhone. It's still an iPhone. But, you know, if you've got a plant and you add another gene to it, it's still a corn plant or a soybean plant, but with a new and better property.
Right. Well, people have a lot of questions about this, in part because of a lack of knowledge, and we're here to address that. This is a call-in show. We've got a caller. Bill, I believe we have Steve on the line.
Steve, where are you calling from?
New Hampshire.
And what's your question?
Well, I wanted to start off by saying I really respected that you, Bill, changed your mind on your stance on GMOs. And I'd like to know if you could kind of walk us through the process that led you to be able to change your mind. And then how do we teach this process to other people? As a science educator, I'm sure that is one of your key ideals behind this podcast and for other people to take away from this.
Well, we change everyone's mind in the entire world with this podcast. I think that's pretty accurate. No, Steve, I kid. So what happened was my sister lived in Australia for a year. My uncle took my sister with him as before we had the term au pair, before we had the term nanny being so common, trying to get a teenage kid to wrangle these toddlers and 8-year-olds. And I guess my sister was mediocre at it, but she spent time in Australia, and she came back with these fantastic and horrible stories about introduced species, the cane toad, that just has made a mess out of the Australian ecosystem. And then we did the Science Guy show, where it was pretty well proven to us by experts that the more diversity in an ecosystem, the more robust it is when the environment changes. And you get diversity by letting things just happen, letting nature take care of itself. So I had the impression that introducing species that would not otherwise have come to be in an ecosystem was akin to or analogous to introducing an invasive species. So that if you want to have an ecosystem be healthy and robust, don't mess with it. It really was not my idea that scientists who are modifying genes were causing harm. It's just that there's a chance of unintended consequences. And this influenced all my thinking until Dr. Fraley, after a debate, which happens here in the big city of New York, New York, town so nice they named it twice, where you debated some people, from one of whom was from the Union of Concerned Scientists. And Dr. Fraley made very compelling points about the nature of humans, scientists, geneticists modifying crops for the betterment of humankind. And then he came up and started talking to me after that debate. Got in my head. He got in my head. So then I paid on my own dime for a trip to St. Louis, Missouri, and I toured Monsanto, and I was very impressed. I remember was maybe 20 years ago, to sequence a human genome would take about a month. At Monsanto, in the case of corn, you guys can sequence the whole flipping thing in 5 minutes. But I went to Monsanto, I walked around, listened to everybody, I looked at the extraordinary work that they were doing.
I think our team said you asked about a million questions, if I recall.
And that sounds like Bill.
And then the other thing I did, I spent a lot of time looking at glyphosate. This is what we all call Roundup as a brand name. And I decided that glyphosate is really not this horrible, evil thing that kills everything. It's targeted at these certain fast-growing weeds. And then I interviewed my uncle, the same guy that took my sister to Australia, was a gentleman farmer, and he had friends. And I talked to those guys, and I found out that everybody uses glyphosate. Like every farmer really many farmers rely on glyphosate because it kills weeds really well without screwing up much else.
Yeah, it means that, you know, in the old days when I was a kid, I'd come home and we'd plow our fields all the fall in order to control the weeds.
You dig up the weeds and turn them over.
But you're not only digging up the weeds, you were digging up the soil. And whenever you do that, you were releasing carbon, you were releasing moisture. So you're really having a very negative effect on the environment. Now what farmers do is they just kill their weeds and they go ahead and plant, and they don't have to do all the tillage and have all the erosion.
You can read the scientific papers, you can do it yourself, but fields treated with glyphosate have more diversity in the microbes that live in the soil. And then I had crossed paths with this home gardening system through Ed Begley, of course, Ed Begley Jr., big environmental guy. And organic farmers spray the leaves with BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, right, which is the same thing that's in the soil, the same thing that the genes of which were put into the successful. These things all came together for me, Steve.
There was also a book that you were working on, I believe.
Well, and then this guy, Corey Powell, was hassling me, and he really challenged me on this. But in the first edition of the book, Undeniable, Bill's Evolution Primer, I stuck to my diversity is good, don't mess with it gun. But after a couple more years went by, I just changed my mind. I decided that genetically modified crops really are in everybody's best interest. The problem was, Rob, you all patented the genes, did not promote the idea that genetically modified crops are great, and you became this pariah. Monsanto became this pariah for for taking over small farmers and killing them almost with your bare hands.
Let's ask Steve. Steve, why does this question interest you? Why were you kind of invested in Bill's evolution on this position?
Really, it mirrors evolutions that I've had many times in changing my mind on various subjects.
Oh, this is great. What have you changed your mind about?
Well, back in the day, I always thought that climate change was something that was being overblown because I didn't think human beings were capable of changing a planet. And I've had to change my mind on that.
That's great.
And I think that is a mark of intellectual honesty that I would love to see other people embrace.
Let me fill in a few blanks here that Bill might have left over. I mean, going back to that intelligence squared debate, I just want everybody to know he was a real pain in the butt with his question. So I kind of sought him out afterwards. It was an exciting night. Who would have ever thought that the pro-GMO side would win a debate in New York, New York? And I have to give all the credit to my partner, Dr. Allison Van Enenem UC Davis. She was great. I give Bill a lot of credit. You know, he showed up and asked a lot of questions, and I think we did buy you lunch. So there's no truth to the rumor that
I don't know of who bought it. We went to the cafeteria and it just showed up.
That's right. That's right. But, you know, your point, changing your mind is the hardest thing to do. And, you know, just like the caller said, you know, I grew up on a farm. I was probably a bit of a climate skeptic myself. And I had a great mentor in St. Louis, Peter Raven, who was the head of the botanical garden, who used to change my mind. And, you know, I think, you know, it's the hardest thing for people to do, but it's the most important thing for progress. If not, you end up like you're in politics or something if you're just holding on to views and opinions without letting the facts and science, you know, guide the decision.
Steve, this is a great question. Thank you very much for getting us started on this. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much for all you do.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. And Bill, you know, somebody who's watched this process of you changing your mind from the outside, I think there's one really important point from Steve's question that, you know, the whole framework of how you change your mind is you have to accept the idea that curiosity and being able to change your mind is a virtue rather than a vice.
Stick around for more Science Rules after this.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Science Rules is back.
A lot of the problem or challenges for you, Rob, in your business back when before you retired and relaxed all the time, was a misconception or the belief or the fear that genetically modified food was somehow different from food. And so this brings us, I believe, to our next caller, Emma. Emma, you're out there. Where are you calling from?
Hi, Bill. I'm calling from Connecticut.
And you have a question for Dr. Fraley.
Yeah, my question is, do GMOs have the ability to alter the DNA of the organisms that consume them?
Like, that is the essence of it.
That's a big question.
If I eat genetically modified popcorn, modified by humans, popcorn, can that popcorn change my DNA?
Right. I eat BT corn, and am I now a BT person?
Good question. And that's one of the, you know, and I'll talk a little bit more about the safety, but it starts with the fact that all living organisms have genes and have proteins. And so, you know, whether you're eating a hamburger or BT corn, that DNA, that protein is digested in your stomach and just turned into amino acids and nucleotides and nutrients. So there's absolutely no concern on the safety of eating.
It's been said that the food you eat as a mammal, the food you eat is no more inside you than your finger is inside the hole of a donut. In other words, it passes through you.
The proteins in your stomach are digested with between probably 10 and seconds in a minute.
All right, that's one thing.
Yeah.
But isn't it a true fact, not a false fact, that when the corn borer, is he a beetle, she?
The corn borer is a caterpillar.
Caterpillar, yeah. So it's a...
If you ever opened that sweet corn and you had that worm inside of it, that's the guy we're talking about.
So that's Lepidoptera.
Yep.
Right, it's an order of insects, the butterflies and moths. And if he or she eats the corn, it crystallizes in his or her gut.
Yeah, the protein actually binds to a receptor, a very specific receptor that's only found on that worm's, the caterpillar's gut, and it causes, it punches a hole in the gut, basically, and eventually stops feeding the insect.
Well, why doesn't that happen to us, Emma's point?
Because we don't have that receptor, and in our system, the protein is degraded just like, you know, protein from any other, you know, food source we eat. I think the question also, Emma, gets to really the key issue of, you know, what are the proofs of safety for GMOs?
Don't you just feed them to lab rats? And
well, there is the lab answer, which is there's been lots of studies and tests done, and you know, this whole area of science and product development is, you know, regulated by the FDA, the EPA, and the USDA, and it, you know, these are you know, tested and thoroughly studied. I think, you know, the real biology answer to your question is, you know, genes are in every living organism. Genes move. We digest genes and DNA and protein all the time, and there's nothing. And then, I guess, from a practical perspective, what I'd tell you is, you know, we talk about GMO still like they're brand new. You know, they've been in the food system for almost 30 years. And in 30 years, there's not been a single issue of illness or food safety. And I just compare and contrast that if you want to, you know, put a benchmark in. If you think about dietary supplements, they send 25,000 people to the hospital every year. A corn plant or a soybean plant has, you know, 25 or 30,000 genes already. You know, we're typically adding one gene that has a very, very specific, very precise function. And when you're eating that corn plant or soybean plant or tomato, you're digesting all of those genes all of the time, and that one gene really makes no difference from a dietary or nutritional perspective.
Emma, thank you. You've asked perhaps the most important question ever is does
in,
it
in the history of questions?
No, but can
but
it?
No.
Can it make you sick? Does it affect you? It's just a great question.
No, it gets to the essence of I think what a lot of people fear about GMOs.
Thank you, Emma. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you.
The other thing people fear is monocrops or overproduction. And is it true that putting these genes in that make a plant resistant to glyphosate to Roundup? Or tolerant of it, making a plant resistant to boll worms, making a plant resistant to borer worms or caterpillar. These things all enable enormous stretches or fields of corn or soybeans to be grown much bigger than was ever possible.
The interesting thing is that if you think about it, you know, from a conceptual perspective, what this technology has enabled is a great increase in the diversity of crop genomes. And when you fly over Iowa and Illinois, it looks like all that corn is the same. But in reality, the advanced breeding techniques, the use of markers, the use of the genetic engineering technology.
Markers and genes.
Right, to be able to breed and create new combinations even faster. The diversity of our crops today is broader than it's ever been. And I think the last piece that's really important, because you mentioned the monoculture piece. Almost all crops are grown in monoculture. So if you're going to grow organic avocados in the Central Valley of California, you're still growing all avocados. You know, you're not interspersing them. So almost all production, whether it's conventional, biotech, or organic, is done in monoculture. The importance of thinking about the monoculture, particularly in the Midwest, and I think this is a key point, is farmers every year are making a decision, do I plant wheat? Do I plant corn? Do I plant soybean? If they're a little farther south, they're going to plant cotton. It's not a decision that they're going to plant something that's going to last for 10 years or 100 years. So it has an enormous flexibility to respond to both market needs and production challenges.
So, Bill, you know who I think is going to help get us to a little deeper into this question?
I got a feeling you know somebody.
I know a guy. I got this guy. His name is Joel. Oh, and he's on the line. That's the cool part.
Joel, thanks for calling. Where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm calling from Boston, Massachusetts.
There you go. And what is your question?
Hi. Thanks, Bill. You actually touched on this a bit earlier. I love the potential of genetic modification, especially in terms of growing food, growing crops with lower water and fertilizer use. But what concerns me was when they're modified to withstand a pesticide or herbicide application. You said that glyphosate doesn't have any adverse effect in humans. It only targets these specific weeds. But how do we know that it doesn't affect any of our biological pathways when they're designed to disrupt the biological processes in these other weeds?
Aha. How about that, Dr. Fraley?
You know, the challenge is, how do you control weeds? In the old days, people used to pull weeds by hand.
You still do that in some parts of the world.
You know, you cultivate and you till, but that has a lot of negative environmental impacts that I talked about earlier.
You dry the soil out
so,
and reduce,
you know,
diversity.
A single application of glyphosate, we're talking about, you know, a piece of land the size of a football field. We'll use just a few ounces to control the weeds. You know, it's an economic and you know, I think of an environmentally attractive choice for a lot of farmers. And you know, these products have been tested and screened and analyzed for years. And I think in the end, in the net, it's a great trade-off for farmers. And it's, you know, a product that's used not only by farmers but by homeowners for controlling their weed pests.
Now, what about this lawsuit, where a gardener claimed that he used so much glyphosate for so many years, so much Roundup for so many years, that it gave him cancer, and he won?
Are you
not allowed to comment?
Well, you know, let me just say this. So, you know, glyphosate's been around for 40 years. It's been thoroughly tested by every major regulatory agency in the world, you know, the EPA here in the U.S., the European regulatory system. All of those regulatory bodies have come to the clear conclusion that, you know, glyphosate is not a carcinogen. There was an unfortunate outlier report from the IARC group in Europe that came to a
IARC group?
International Research for Cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And it came with a different conclusion. Put in perspective, the European regulatory process took about 4 years to complete the updated analysis of the data. The IARC review was less than a week. IARC is the same agency that's determined that coffee, red meat, cinnamon, and night shifts are carcinogens. So it's an outlier, and you know, it's an unfortunate situation, and in many ways, I think in the end, science will prevail, you know, and, you know, that's certainly something that, you know, as we talk about GMOs in general, the science is one thing, but, you know, as you've always championed, the communication of science, making people comfortable with it, and making sure that, you know, it ends up with the right policymaking are really key.
All right. Now, what about the bees? I have met beekeepers who insist that glyphosate has killed their bees.
Actually, if you take it at a high level, the biotech traits, particularly the insect-protected crops, have been really beneficial. Prior to these crops, farmers were often using broad-spectrum insecticides that would kill all the insects. Mm-hmm. With the BT crops, you're only targeting that caterpillar, so you're getting very, very specific
bees
control.
Bees can handle the protein. They don't eat the corn.
Yeah, they don't eat the corn. They don't ever get exposed. They don't have the receptors. So you've really seen a huge improvement there. You know, I think the science really on bee health, the experts that I've met with all really focus on the culprit with bee health is the varroa mite. So this is another example of one of those pests that's traveled around the world.
You guys, this thing, you go to these bee meetings and the varroa mite, imagine a big crab, like a Dungeness crab, on your chest. Now you're going to walk around and enjoy your day with a crab on your chest. And that's what this mite is.
Yeah, so think the movie Alien.
Yeah,
It's kind of like that. Yeah.
So there's an animal much smaller than a bee that is a parasite for the bee, another arthropod, another...
And not only is it a parasite, you know, kind of draining the bee blood, the hemolymph, but it's also infecting the bee with viruses. And it's weakening the whole hive. And that's... Most people accept that as, from the science perspective, that's the cause of colony collapse disorder.
Is this now, mite?
The mite. And so the good news is there, these advanced biology tools, being able to understand the sequence of the bee genome, the mite genome, are creating the opportunity to use some of these tools to target the mite specifically. You know, it's a real challenge to think, how do you control one insect living on another one?
Is the mite an insect or some other arthropod?
That's another arthropod, yeah. But it's the idea of how do you do that targeting, and some of the new advanced techniques like the RNAi, probably some of the gene editing tools, are going to create, I think, unique opportunities for protecting the bee population.
So we're covering a lot of territory here.
And ribonucleic acid interferon? Is that what that is?
RNAi.
Yeah, so Joel, I hope this put your mind somewhat at ease and sort of took you off into a number of new things to think about.
And thank you for calling, Joel.
Thank you so much. I would love to see a future where we have glow-in-the-dark street trees instead of streetlights.
Ooh, that's on.
There's a company working on that, as you know.
Wow.
Science Rules will be right back.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
You're listening to Science Rules.
Well, before we go or start to go or do the next thing, Carl, are you out there? Where are you calling from and what's your question?
Hi, I'm in Sparks, Nevada.
I've been to Sparks, the home of Jugs pitching machines. And so what goes on? What is your question?
I want for you guys to talk about how GMOs can help plant-based foods taste like animal products, but are better for our health and the planet, like how Impossible Foods has made the Impossible Burger and they're working on the Impossible Steak.
Any comments on Impossible Burgers?
I've tried them. They're actually pretty good.
So what have they done? They've put the heme gene?
They put the heme, and they've used a variety of different, extraction of different plant proteins and done the formulation. There's some really cool things going on, as you know, in this whole area of using both the GMO technology, but increasingly the gene editing technology, which in many ways is the next generation. Gene editing has just been around for the last 6 or 7 years, but I think the last time I looked, there's now 15,000 scientific publications on gene editing. It's being used across a variety of opportunities to cure human diseases as well as improved crop agriculture. On the human health side, people are using it to literally cure genetic diseases, cancers, AIDS. I mean, it's phenomenal. I mean, it's a remarkable tool. Our food supply today has been one that we've created in terms of higher yields and better nutrition. Particularly, though, on the gene editing side, if you look at the 15 products that are being now tested and developed, almost all of them are nutritional enhancements. We've got soybeans with healthier oil. We've got potatoes and apples with better shelf life. People are researching how do you take the allergens out of peanuts or how do you take the gluten out of wheat. I mean, I see a wave of new techniques using gene editing that are approaching, improving foods. And, the beauty of gene editing is think about it as a search and replace function on your computer. You know, with gene editing, you can quickly go in and replace a given base pair and a given gene. I was judging science contests at the high school level last year, and they were doing gene editing studies in high school. So the beauty of this tool, unlike the GMOs, it's not introducing a new gene. It's changing what's already there. So it's not going to have the extensive regulatory costs. It's accessible, like I said, by kids in high school. We're seeing there may be 100 new companies starting up using this technology across the country. We're seeing this technology being used by small startups in Africa.
You're not concerned that somebody's going to misuse it and accidentally create a deadly combination of something or other?
No more. I mean, gene editing is no different than breeding. You know, every time a breeder makes a cross, they're recombining and creating mutations and new genes. It's the same type of testing and selection that we've used for 8,000 years to, turn the wild crops into cultivated crops and our fruits and vegetables today. So, and most governments are looking at it exactly through that lens that, the process of gene editing creates the same kind of products that would come from traditional breeding.
But it's faster and more targeted, right?
Very precise, and that's the beauty. So, and lower cost. So unlike GMOs, which, as Bill knows, only some of the larger companies could afford to do, this really democratizes the access to the technology. In fact, I'd make the point that when you look at the future, one of the things that's going to be so much different from the past is you take a look at the advances in gene editing can be used universally, small companies, large companies, universities, high school kids. You think about the advances, with digital ag and the fact
digital
that—
Digital ag.
Like—
Digital
agriculture, the fact that for the ag industry, the farming industry is the last industry of the world to become digitized. We have, think about smallholder farmers in Africa. 70% of them have access to a cell phone, and that means that they can now get weather information, they can get agronomic advice, they can explore which village has the highest price. These tools are dramatically changing information flow and accessibility to be able to grow better crops around the world. And so they're very different than the kinds of advances that, were used in agriculture up until today.
The other thing is it true that most of the time when you breed a new crop or modify it, it works not as well as the existing one? It's only now and then that you get an improvement. Is that a myth?
I would say that 50-50. You make a lot of crosses, but you're only screening, selecting, advancing the stuff that's better. When I was a kid leaving my dad's farm to go to college in 1970, the corn yields in this country were for the first time they were 75 bushels an acre.
75 bushels an acre.
So,
can you do that in metric for me?
I can do it in pounds. It's 55 pounds to a bushel. Today, they're 175.
So, it's almost a factor of it's more than a factor of three.
And that's happened in all the crops. So, these processes of breeding have now become better because we know every gene in the plant. We're literally being able to breed gene by gene.
Can grow three times as much food
on
per
one acre.
Hectare per acre than when you were a kid.
And the key to that, when we talk about agriculture, it's hard not to talk about climate change. Because in many parts of the world and in many, perspectives, agriculture is a contributor to greenhouse gases. I mean, we have every time you plow, you release carbon. You've got the
You've got tractors and so on.
You got the fertilizers that release nitrogen. You got the cow farts that release methane.
It's really their belches. Am I right?
Yeah, you got it right. Yeah. So there's a contribution there to climate change. On the other hand, you know, I'll put this into perspective for you. You know, when I grew up, when I was born in 1950, there were 2.5 billion people on the planet. Now there's 7.5 billion. We've added 5 billion people, but we're still farming about the same amount of land as we did in 1950. And that's because the unit production per acre has increased so dramatically. And the last point that's important in that is plants are the only process that's natural that fixes carbon. So every time, you know, these crops are increasing their photosynthetic capacity and their yield, they're actually, you know, contributing by absorbing and fixing more carbon. In fact, a high-yielding Midwest cornfield actually is a net carbon fixer.
Whoa. But then that, I mean, that corn gets harvested and recycled. I mean, it's carbon neutral. It's not a permanent carbon sink.
Well, they put the, you know, again, so this, the science here is if you're not tilling the soil, those roots and leaves, you know, stay in the soil. So, and if you're using cover crops and, you know, we can see the path forward, you know, where high yielding crops will be sources of carbon sinks.
Whereas if you kept tilling those fields in the old style, all that carbon would be coming back out.
And if you were growing 75 bushel acre corn versus 175, you're not fixing nearly as much carbon.
There you go. Carl, that was a great question. You took us a long way there, man. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So Sarah T. has a question about CRISPR. CRISPR is gene editing, which is not the same as gene modification. Is that right?
That's right.
Sarah T., are you out there? Sarah T.
Hi, Bill. I'm here.
Where are you calling from?
Columbia, South Carolina.
There you go. And what is your question?
My question is CRISPR the main tool used for commercialized production of GMOs, or are there other older tools out there still in use?
It's a good question. Rob?
Well, I would say most of the GMO crops, you know, that are in the market today in corn, soybean, and cotton are all produced using the older agrobacterium.
Oh, the old, way back, years ago.
The stuff back when I was a kid, you know. Yeah.
So and this is using a virus to carry?
This is the bacterium.
Stone knife and bearskin style genetic engineering, I believe they call it.
It's interesting. It's a natural process that we've piggybacked on to introduce genes into plants. It's very efficient. It works with the broadleaf plants like the soybeans and the grasses like the corn and others. But today, we're using the gene editing tools. There's a variety of gene editing tools. There's some of the protein-based ones like the Talens. There's the
Talen,
T-A-L-E-N, and that uses a protein that can cut the DNA. And of course, the CRISPR system came from bacteria. It's a defense mechanism, really, and a protection mechanism in bacteria. The other thing that's going on is as scientists are doing more and more of the genome sequencing of different microbes, new gene editing tools are being advanced almost every year.
So are CRISPR tools in any of the, were they used to create any of the food that we're eating right now, or is that not commercialized yet?
Not right now, but there's about 15 products that are awaiting final approvals and moving forward.
When you say products, what are you talking about?
The ones that are most noteworthy, there's a soybean with a healthier oil. There's the potatoes and apples that don't brown. Mm-hmm. There's people right now working on, you know, taking that allergen out of wheat and out of peanuts and crops like that. And one of the really exciting ones is plants, you know, fix carbon through photosynthesis. They're studying that whole photosynthetic pathway and starting to make the subtle changes to improve the efficiency of photosynthesis, which would really unlock a lot of future yield.
So if I understand it, and Sarah, this is a great question. If I understand it, photosynthesis relies on the sort of reddish light.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the great evolutionary mysteries or ironies or interesting ease is that plants reflect all this green light, but green light's the most abundant light from the sun, most abundant frequency from
and
the sun.
And it's more energetic. It's great light.
Yeah, it's super light.
I love
but,
that light.
So are you suggesting or proposing that there might be a future plant that uses a more energetic part of the spectrum or what, or just was it going to be more efficient?
I think there's a, right now they're targeting greater efficiency in the process. And, you know, there's, you know, as you said, there's the light harvesting, you know, centers and the reaction centers that, that create the energy to be able to do the carbon fixation process. But clearly things that we would have thought impossible a decade ago, now with the gene editing technology advances where you can actually, you know, think through this, that that search and replace function to modify a complex set of the proteins that would be involved in photosynthesis now are possible.
So I'm picturing redesigned chlorophyll that uses green and blue light and fields and fields of red plants. So, you know, they can do, you know, giant red fields.
Well, copper beaches.
Yeah,
I think
you're telling me that's possible, or
it,
at least
it is being worked on by scientists today.
Wow.
Yeah. And there'll be a future when. Why did they want things green? That's weird. Yeah. I can, well, anyway, Sarah T, thank you. A great question. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Carry on. Oh, Corey.
Wait, is it raining in the? Oh no, that's thunder associated with lightning, meaning
that's right.
Lightning.
It's the shock
round.
Waves in the atmosphere
lightning
and the
round.
Lightning round.
Lightning
yes,
round.
So
okay.
Rob,
are you
Dr.
ready for
Fraley?
Lightning?
I'm ready.
All right, what is the weirdest thing you eat, Rob?
Oh gosh, let me think. What
what's,
is the weirdest
what do you
thing?
Eat the most of?
I love all kinds of seafood, so I like to eat octopus and things like that.
Your traditional St. Louis diet.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ocean-going animals. Do you recycle?
I do.
What do you recycle?
For us, it's usually a lot of plastic bottles and paper.
All right. Do you prefer paper or plastic bags at the grocery store?
I almost always get paper.
All right. Almost always.
Almost.
Yeah. Do you use green energy? Renewable energy.
I'm in a part of town where we don't have solar panels.
Wow, that's weird.
Yeah, I know.
So is your energy company going to provide that soon enough? This is in Missouri, right?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, we have access to nuclear plants in Missouri. You know, that's always for me the option that's on the table that we need to look at really hard.
Would you like to see everything we eat engineered?
Well, I don't have to wait for that because everything we eat today is engineered in one way or another. You know, here's the simple test. If you landed on Plymouth Rock and you said, what do they grow in this big country? The only thing we would have had back then would have been probably strawberries and chestnuts and maybe some wild sunflowers. Everything else we grow in this country, corn came from Mexico, potatoes came from Peru, wheat came from Asia, all the vegetables came from Europe. They were all, you know, selected, bred, and genetically modified to grow in this country.
Thank you, Rob Fraley. Thank you for joining us for this exciting episode of Science Rules.
Rob, great having you here.
It really has been great. He is the former CTO, Chief Technology Officer of Monsanto, which is now Bayer. Right?
That's right. Yep.
And he helped develop the very first genetically modified seeds ever used on any farm 40 years ago or whatever.
Speaking of which, I was going to talk to you about a little problem we have.
What's that?
What's that?
Well, you know, those corn plants that you made a couple years ago, we still got them in the greenhouse there. We're thinking we may need to charge you a little bit of rent for those. I mean, they're taking up quite a bit of space there.
Let me know. So thank you, Rob, for coming on the show and giving us really a good perspective on genetically modified organisms in general and in general and genetically modified food. I'm Bill Nye.
I am Corey S. Powell.
And remember, when it comes to the genetically modified part of our universe, science rules. So if you like the show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcast. Check it out on Stitcher because the ratings and the reviews really help us improve the show. They help us find what people want to listen to, and it spreads the word about the show so that more people will listen so that we can, dare I say it, change the world. Science Rules is produced by Jordan Bell. Our engineer today is none other than Jared O'Connell. Mixing and the original theme music were by Casey Halford. And special thanks, of course, to Claire Rawlinson. And keep in mind, everyone, Chris Bannon is the CCO, the Chief Content Officer here at Stitcher, where science rules.
Stitcher.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.